Let's talk. John Brown. Postcards from Santiago, the George Robledo story, the first overseas star of English football before Haaland, Thierry Henry, and Ouar Cantona. There was George Robledo, the first overseas star of English football. It's a fascinating tale. I've never heard of this one before, but here to tell us more about it is the author of Postcards from Santiago, Spencer Vignes. Good morning to you, Spencer.
Good morning, everyone. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad. Whereabouts are you, by the way, today, Spencer?
Well, this morning I'm in Cardiff, South Wales.
Right.
And the sun is shining, which it doesn't very much in South Wales, so we're making the most of it.
People are wandering around, pointing to the sky and going, what is that strange foreign object?
What is this crazy thing and how do we behave when such an event happens?
Now, talking about crazy things and such an event, from Chile to the Premier League, the Division One. Well, just explain to us a little bit, Spencer, about your background and how you came to hear about this tale.
Well, I'm a sports writer and broadcaster, and I've got to be honest. I mean, I didn't really know much about this guy, George Robledo, either. A couple of years ago, about two and a half years ago, I was doing a quiz, a sports quiz, and one of the questions was, word for word, this is it, right? It was, who holds the record for the most league goals scored by an overseas player in the top flight of English football in a single season? And the quizmaster asked this question, and we kind of sat there in silence. And then one by one, you know, some of the answers started coming in, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo, Jürgen Klinsmann, Thierry Henry, you know, guess after guess after guess after guess. And no one got it right, apart from finally one guy said, George Robledo. And the quizmaster went, correct. And my memory, the only time I'd ever heard of this guy before was when I was covering a Newcastle game many, many years ago when the late, great Bobby Robson was their manager. And Bobby Robson had grown up as a Newcastle fan in the post-war years, and George Robledo had been one of his heroes. And Bobby Robson was just talking after one game in a post-match press conference about the people he'd watched in the late 1940s. Adoring, and George Robledo was one of them. So my mind went back to this guy, and I remembered Bobby Robson talking about him. And then I thought, yeah, that would be a good book. You know, I wouldn't mind reading that. So I went looking for one, and there wasn't one. And to somebody like me who's done a few books in the past and loves a good story, particularly about football as it was, you know, Premier League now is great, but what really sets my pulse racing is, you know, the stories of old. You know, you said about Premier League then, but of course there was a Division One before all of that. There's all this history, this untapped, great, great stuff before the Premier League. And George Robledo is part of that.
I mean, from Chile to, you know, to Barnsley or something, or from Chile to Newcastle, it's a convoluted tale because, you know, we now live in a time when, you know, you know every league team's got some sort of silky South American they've signed when they're 14 years old from somewhere. But of course, back in the late 40s, early 50s, it wasn't a case of leaping on the nearest Airbus and coming over. And, you know, it was, as Americans say, a darn sight more complicated than that. So what's the backstory of this one then?
Well, the backstory is that, I mean, George was born in Chile and his two younger brothers were both born out there. And his dad was Chilean, but his mother was actually originally from Yorkshire. She'd gone out to work in South America, as you do, as a kind of governess to work for a family out there who were involved in the mining industry. And that mining, you know, that work took her from Argentina originally to Chile. And she was working with her husband, who she met out there, in the Atacama Desert, which is the most, I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
It's
the
most
unhospitable place on planet Earth by all accounts. I haven't been there. I'm going to go there because I just want to see what nothing and heat looks and
feels. If you know the James Bond film, what is it, the Quantum of Solace, or it's called The Question of Sport or whatever, that, a lot of that is shot in the what's it, desert.
Well, apparently it's where NASA also go to test out anything that they might be sending to Mars, because that's what they reckon Mars looks and feels like.
Wow.
And yeah, so George and his family were born there in this mining town in the middle of nowhere. And then the mine was shut down and was in danger of closing. So they decided to relocate, get out of town. And they decided they were going to go to Yorkshire, as you do. Or she decided she was going to return to Yorkshire, to her home county. And George's dad, get this, on the day the boat was due to leave Chile and the family are on the boat and they're all about to go back to, well, you know, go to England. And George's dad says, oh, I don't know if I've got enough cigarettes on me to last the 6 week journey back to England. I'm just going to nip on shore, just get some cigarettes. I'll be back in a minute. And he goes, you know, that old chestnut. And he goes ashore and they never, well, he doesn't come back. So the ship sets sail with George's mum, George, and his two brothers for England. And his dad does a runner. Why? We don't really know. Whether he had something else on the go or whatever, or he couldn't face leaving Chile, we really don't know. But he got cold feet at the end and didn't go with them.
Do they, I mean, spoiler alert, do they ever see him again?
George does. Because George goes to England, he grows up in Yorkshire, he becomes a fine footballer, he joins Barnsley, then Newcastle, and then word gets back to Chile that, oi, you've got a footballer in England who's pulling up trees and doing wonderful things. So George gets selected to play for Chile in the first World Cup after the Second World War.
Right.
So George goes back to Chile to do some preparations and meet his teammates for the first time. Before going to Brazil, and he meets his dad then.
Oof.
How it was left, we don't really know, because George's dad died the following year. So whether they built bridges and were maybe going to see each other again, we don't know.
Right.
Because
fair enough. That's an interesting one indeed. So, I mean, that must have been a horrendous journey over. And then presumably they arrive in, I mean, this is pre-war. I mean, what period are you talking about? Because he becomes a Bevan boy, so therefore it must be just as the war's starting. Tell me a little bit about the...
They arrive in the mid-1930s.
Right.
And so he grows up in the Yorkshire of the Depression, really. The mines are still working. You know, there's plenty of jobs down the mine, but it's a happy life to an extent, but it's a hard life, you know, as South Yorkshire was then. I mean, death was all around because the mines were still working and, you know, you had pit accidents all the time. It was a hard existence, but he loved it. He really, really loved it. He was good at football. He was popular with his classmates.
So he goes to work down the pits. He becomes, the war breaks out, which must have been, you know, an interesting time for him, to put it mildly. He becomes a Bevan boy, of course, because it's a trade that you don't have to go and serve, you know, on the front line, etc. War finishes. You say he's been playing football in Barnsley. So when the people realise that he's quite good, so he's in Yorkshire. He's working down pit, as saying would go. And what was the other saying? You could always find a fast bowler or a football player just by yelling down a Yorkshire mine shaft and somebody would come up. He was good.
Pretty much.
So he starts playing, when do people realise that, you know, this young Chilean kid, who presumably speaks with a Yorkshire accent by now, is quite, which is an interesting thing, is quite a good footballer. Where does he make his debut?
Well, I think they'd realised with him playing at school, he was playing kind of, you know, school football before the war, and he was smashing all sorts of records and things like that. So local clubs were kind of onto him from quite an early stage. Huddersfield were after him, but it was Barnsley who got him, which was his local club, really. And so he joined them, played for them during what was known as the Wartime League, because some form of football continued during the war years, to kind of, you know, allegedly to keep the masses entertained and for something to do for people who were still back, you know, on the home front. And then when football resumes again in 1946, you know, with the Football League picks up again, he just starts scoring goals for fun and creating goals for fun. And he does wonders at Barnsley in what is now the Championship in England. And that starts alerting all of the top clubs. So you've got Spurs being interested, Manchester City are interested, you know, but it's Newcastle who get his signature. And so he moves to Newcastle in 1949 and, you know, just becomes part of a wonderful team up there. that are in the top flight of English football and start winning cups. They win the FA Cup in 1951, and George is part of that team. And then they win the FA Cup again the following year, 1952, and he scores the winner, the only goal in the game against Arsenal then.
Yeah.
And so he becomes, you know, he becomes a local hero quite quickly.
And this is the thing, is it, because he, you know, he is part of that great, I mean, I know that Newcastle have finally got another trophy to their cabinet this year, but I mean, he becomes part of that legendary team, isn't he?
Yeah, part of that legendary team. They won the FA Cup. I mean, back then, it's hard to imagine for many kind of young people now, but I mean, back then the FA Cup was, in many ways, bigger than winning the league. It was the biggest trophy on planet Earth. It was bigger than the World Cup. European Cup, of course, hadn't really started then or anything. So, you know, it was this huge thing which, you know, the world stopped for. Everybody stopped. Everything stopped for the FA Cup. And Newcastle won it in 51 and 52, and they won it again in 55. But by 1955, George had returned to Chile because he was doing so well with Newcastle that basically quite a lot of teams in South America want to sign him. Of course, there's no maximum wage in South America at the time, which there was in English football. You couldn't get paid more than, well, it got in the end to £20 per week.
Right.
Which is crazy compared to today, didn't it? But in South America, there was, you know, sky was the limit. So he could go back there and earn what he wanted. So and Chile, go on.
I was going to say, and also he gets to play for the national team, and he gets to take part in the 1950 World Cup, for goodness sake. I mean, this is the one that Uruguay win it, of course. So it's South American football is a good thing. He's going back, you know, is a huge deal, and he's going back to the place of his birth.
And the crazy thing is, as well, Giles, is in his first game. All right, you can script this. His first game for Chile. Back in the World Cup, or his first game ever for Chile, was against England.
Oh, no.
In the World Cup. They drawn each other. And in that game, he sets another kind of... He was notable for a number of firsts. He was the first foreign player of his player to score in an FA Cup final. He was the first to do this, first to do that. But one of his many firsts was he was the first player from the Football League to face off against England in a competitive international, you know, somebody, so in other words, he wasn't from Ireland, in other words, as well. So Chile play England in the World Cup in 1950 in Rio de Janeiro, and England win 2-0, but George actually, quite famously, in it, he takes a free kick and he hits the crossbar. And during the resulting corner, one of the England defenders comes over to him and just pats him on the back and just says, "George, remember, you're not playing for Newcastle now, mate."
I mean, it's a family affair, isn't it? Because his brother, Ted, he also plays, doesn't he, for the national team?
Yeah, his brother, Ted, he wasn't as kind of quite as glamorous as George or quite as talented, but... he made a good, steady career. Well, he actually did better than a steady career. He also, George had this thing where wherever he went, he would take George with him as part of the deal.
Right.
So it's like, you know, when he went to Newcastle, it was like, well, he said to Newcastle, "If you want to sign me, you've got to sign me and my brother." When he then left Newcastle and went back to play for Colo Colo, who were like the Manchester United, Liverpool of Chile, it was like, well, you can sign me, but my brother has to be part of the deal as well. So it was a real family affair. But yeah, his brother did more than make up the numbers. I mean, his brother played in the 1952 FA Cup final for Newcastle as well.
Yeah.
And later played for Chile. So yeah, he was a talent in himself, definitely.
I mean, he's scoring goals for fun, is he, when was at Newcastle? I mean, it's back-to-back FA Cups and all that, or FA Cup final appearances. And he comes, does it? I mean, he's a folk hero. I mean, he even makes it to a John Lennon album, doesn't he? The front of is it Hartson? I can't remember the name of the album cover now. But
Walls and Bridges.
Right, so that's the one. Okay.
Walls and Bridges. Well, this is bizarre. So like, and this is, you can imagine what I felt like, you know, when you start looking back at this guy's life and there's all of these firsts and these scoring records and the World Cup. And then John Lennon comes into it. You're just like, what?
Yeah.
And you think, well, how? And it turns out that in 1952, when Newcastle beat Arsenal in the FA Cup final at Wembley Stadium, and George scored the winning goal. And the picture of him scoring the winning goal, heading the winning goal, was, of course, in all the national papers the following day and on the Monday. And John Lennon, who at the time was 11 years old and growing up in Liverpool, must have seen this picture and decided that he was going to do a painting of it. He either did it at home or he did it at school. He was still in his last year of primary school at the time. So we're not sure where he did this painting, but he painted a picture of George scoring this winning goal in the FA Cup final. And he kept it. Back at home. And I mean, you know, by the 1970s, John was living in New York City. He just recorded the album Walls and Bridges, and he's thinking, well, what do I put on the cover of this album? And for whatever reason, he sent for some of the paintings that he'd done at primary school back in his childhood in Liverpool. And the painting that jumps out is him scoring George scoring the winning goal in this game. And it's strange because Lennon, from what we can gather, wasn't really much of a football fan.
Yeah.
So why he went for this, we don't know. And of course, we can't ask him because he's dead. But what doesn't change is the fact that, yeah, if you look on the front of the 1974 John Lennon album, Walls and Bridges, there's a painting that he did, John Lennon did, at 11 years old, and it's of George Robledo heading his winning goal for Newcastle in 1952.
You thought it would have been a Liverpool thing, wouldn't you? But there you go. And there's even a blue plaque, isn't there? They've got a blue plaque for where they were living, the brothers?
Yeah. There's a blue plaque in West Melton, in Yorkshire, where they lived, and there's a blue plaque in Newcastle on the house in there's an area of Newcastle called Fenham,
right,
which is about 25 minute walk from St James's Park, Newcastle's home. And so there's two blue plaques on those houses that were put up 2 or 3 years ago,
right,
just marking the fact that, you know, the Robledo family lived in these houses. So yeah, so they had the blue plaques, and some people remembered them and whatever. But, you know, I think the thing that seemed to work against the Robledos, and George in particular, was when he went back to Chile in 1953, his story kind of went with him. You know, it's not like, you know, you think if he'd have stayed in this country, you know, his memory would have perpetuated, you know, like Jackie Milburn, like, you know, the Cheltenham brothers, and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. But I think because he went back to South America, that was that. And the only people who remembered him were the people who remembered him playing. Because, of course, there's very little in the way of moving pictures or film or radio commentary of him playing, because, of course, of, you know, it's a long time ago before Sky TV, Match of the Day and what have you. So his story almost kind of died with him. So I think that's why I felt motivated to kind of put him back on the map a bit, or try and put him back on the map by doing this book.
I mean, there is a bit of tragedy because his brother, you know, he's working on an oil tanker in Dubai?
Yeah.
And he disappears. He's never seen, presumably he goes over the edge, over the side, and never seen again.
Yeah, there was a court case out in the Middle East. The captain of the tanker was put on trial for murdering Edward, or right, Ted, his brother. They're not sure what really happened, and the witnesses were unreliable, and the tanker captain was found not guilty. So, but they think the finger of suspicion does tend to point towards him. But either way, they never found the body, so they don't know. So, yeah, there is this element of, you know, George had this wonderful life in terms of, you know, what he did as a footballer, and also the way that he lived. You know, he was very much a glass half full kind of man, but there is, it is tainted by sadness in terms of, you know, what happened with, you know, his dad walking out of his life age 6.
Yeah.
You know, and the hard life he had growing up, and of course, you know, Ted's supposed murder, which was in the early 1970s.
Yeah.
So, kind of haunted by that quite a bit.
And, I mean, we've only got about a minute left, so I'm really sorry about this. But, I mean, he passes away, he had a heart attack, 62, doesn't he? But, I mean, his life, though, in Chile, I mean, he was a superstar, wasn't he, in Chile? That's fair.
Yeah. I've got to say, you know, it's like Spain, Italy, you know, Argentina, Chile. They're very good at remembering the footballing greats in those countries in a way that maybe Britain isn't so much. You know, if you were part of the Premier League, then you're celebrated. If you were kind of pre-Premier League, you know, you tend to get forgotten about a bit now, you know, airbrushed out of history. And in Chile, no, he's celebrated still as not just one of their great footballers or sportsmen, but one of the the Chilean greats of all time, you know, one of their great personalities, one of their great citizens. So they tend to remember him, us less so, but hey, hopefully that'll change now.
Exactly. I'm going to run out of time. If people want to find you online, Spencer, where's the best place to find you?
I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter or X or whatever they're calling it today, Spencer Vignis with a V and a hard G, and I'm on Blue Sky as well, so come and find me.
And you can order the book via our own virtual bookstore, just click on the link and it'll be winging its way to you. The book is called Postcards from Santiago, absolutely big. Spencer Vignis, thank you so much for your time today.
It's a pleasure, Giles.